We continue with the conclusion of the interview.
It's a problem because what do you do if it's 20-25% of society are authoritarian followers who are very, as you described correctly, very active, very energized, probably very religious, and you can't really talk to them. We've got all these Democratic parties effort at the grassroots level all over the place, and sometimes that makes sense to me, and yet sometimes I think to myself, well, there's a bunch of red states out there that basically you should just write off because you're never going to get to them, and concentrate on building up political structures elsewhere, and who knows what will happen with those areas. But I know this is getting outside your area as a psychologist, but that leads into your thoughts about the dangers we face as a society, because we have to find some kind of coping mechanism for dealing with this small but still very significant group of people.
Yes, we do, because they are so very active. Religious right. I mean, most people are not authoritarians, and most Republican supporters are not in the religious right, for example. And most people aren't Republicans, and yet for the last 8 years up until the 2006 election, the religious right and the people it has elected has run the country. So, and then look what's happened, my God, in that time. It's as good an indication as possibly you could have that authoritarianism is very dangerous and very unhealthy for a democracy. And so look what happened when they got into power, the country is nowadays. So if you're asking me what should people do about this, are you asking me that?
Well, sort of,
Well, I think the first thing that I say is that you've got to get politically active in response. You've got to get into this process, and you have to become as energetic and as hardworking and as well-organized as the religious right is. And they lead the league in those things. They are very zealous. They lead the world, they lead the North America, anyway, in being zealous. And so they're going to have their candidates stand for election in the party they choose, and their candidates are going to have a good chance of winning regardless of the polls. In the 2006 election, midterm elections, only 40% of the registered voters in the United States cast a ballot. Now, if there is a segment of the population that turns out almost 100% to vote for their candidates, 25% of the population can win a lot of elections if 60% of the population is staying home. So you've got to get involved, and you've got to go through the legitimate, regular political processes and elect different people, non-authoritarian, less authoritarian people, to power.
But then when we elect the Democrats...
if that's who it is, yeah.
Just looking at the Congress now, Senator Reid and Congresswoman Pelosi, they've managed to avoid doing what people thought they'd elected them to do. So how do you I wouldn't say that either of those members of Congress are authoritarian, but they're going along with the authoritarian program, aren't they? Or I don't know, how would you describe what's happening there?
Well, certainly disappointing. I think they're doing it. I think everybody understands they're doing it for political reasons in the long run. They want to win in 2008, and they don't want to do things that will give their opposition easy attack points on them, like you stab the troops in the back, to quote Hitler. So certainly a lot of people are disappointed in them. But if you asked me right now, would I rather have more Republicans in power or more Democrats in power, right now the answer would have to be more Democrats.
Yeah.
Now, I have to also say here that I'm an independent, and I think probably more moderate than everybody assumes I am.
Right.
So I can see myself voting for Republican candidates sometime. but I don't see myself right now voting for any Republicans. I mean, it depends on what the issues are and who the people are as well, of course.
And yet, one of the problems with the strategy of playing for 2008 that you described, and I think quite accurately as what they're thinking, is that by rolling over essentially on a lot of these issues, particularly on Iraq, they're just encouraging the White House to go full court with whatever else they may have in mind, and those could be very bad things. So it seems to me that the Democrats are really shouldering a fairly significant part of the responsibility for whatever may happen by not acting as an effective opposition.
Yeah, I think you're saying that the Democrats are more interested in what's best for them than in what's best for the country.
Right.
Well, I think that's something you get with political parties in Canada and in the United States. And that's why I'm an independent, because I think they will put their own interest ahead. I can't disagree with your analysis at all.
Is there any kind of special insight we might have into how people like Reid and Pelosi could be induced to change their behavior to be a little more confrontational with the authoritarian leaders that they're confronting?
Well, I think it's too close to the election for them to change much. I'm sure they'll start maneuvering and positioning themselves when they feel it's safe to do, farther away from where they've been, when they see what is actually going to be happening in the economy and in Iraq and so on. They're doing so well right now in terms of the alienation of the American public from the Republican Party that I'm sure they'll be tempted to stay the course. As to what you can do to try and get them to be more outspoken and critical and less cooperative and so on, there are the things that I understand they respond to most of all, and that is expressed public pressure. Mm-hmm. And that's something that the religious right does magnificently. They are so good at organizing write-ins and petitions and phone-ins and so on that they can, in an instant, flood people, flood legislators with opinions about right to life or the next Supreme Court nominee and so on.
Jerry Schiavo.
Exactly. And so the people who don't want that kind of future for the country have got to get real good at that too.
So that's interesting. So if you had a progressive phone bank or people who could whip up 10,000 calls on a particular day and crash the Capitol Hill reception, that would get Reid and Pelosi's attention.
Oh, I'm sure it would. It works the other way when other people do that. So yeah, I think so, and I think there are attempts, aren't there, going on to organize these kinds of email messaging systems and so on by progressives. I've run across them as I've been cruising around.
Some, but my sense of it is that they haven't been particularly effective. Or the ones that have been on a larger scale, for example, by Move On, have been pretty much directed by a small group of people at the top, and those people are more interested in supporting the Democratic Party per se than they are in fighting over particular policies. So I think that my sense of it is that up to now anyway, nobody has really figured out a good mechanism for using the internet to actually connect people's basic political priorities with some kind of a massively organized expression to the Congress.
Maybe George Kenney will organize something like that.
I don't know about that. I'm not sure I'm that good at organizing, for one thing. But
the answer has to be yes.
Uh-huh.
Organized political expression is much more effective than probably anything except dollars.
To go back to One question I wanted to be sure to ask you. What you've noticed that authoritarians tend to want to persecute homosexuals, unless they happen to know a gay person or they've been educated, you say, about sexual preference having a biological basis. But what about authoritarian gays and Republicans like Senator Craig? My sense of it is, knowing a few people who are Republicans and work on Capitol Hill, that there's actually a very large number of people in the Republican leadership who are closeted homosexuals. It's not.
Yeah.
So it's such a weird thing. How are we supposed to understand this phenomenon? And is there any, what's the appropriate response to it?
These things don't happen often enough so that you can do scientific studies of them. So I don't have any sort of research blessed opinion on this. The best I can do is say that authoritarian leaders can sometimes have a lot of the characteristics of their followers in terms of their mental blindness and their compartmentalized thinking and their hypocrisy and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I can point to various examples of this that don't have anything to do with homosexuality.
Okay, well, take a couple examples then.
Let me first just say, we call these people double highs because they score highly on both the measure of being an authoritarian leader and an authoritarian follower. They're not followers, but they have a lot of the characteristics of the follower. And these are the people, by and large, who I think end up being authoritarian legislators, authoritarian politicians.
Mm-hmm.
They're people we call double highs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for an example, I'll give you the example of Tom DeLay, who when his semi-autobiography came out, John Dean asked me to comment on that. And we wrote a fine law interview for John's site on that.
Mm-hmm.
If you read DeLay's biography, you see that in places the man is obviously lying, and he must know he's lying.
Mm-hmm.
So he presents defenses of things that happened to him, charges that were brought against him, corruption charges when he was the House Speaker, probably the leader of the Republican Party in the House, and he is so selective with his facts. He is so clearly presenting a biased picture that he must know that he is speaking to an audience that wants to believe and won't look up the story.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, he also sort of blindly reveals hypocrisy in a number of the things that he talks about, which indicate that neither he nor his editor must have sat down and said, look, what you say in chapter 7 is just so directly contradictory to what you say in chapter 3 that what are you talking about? So, for example, when the Monica Lewinsky Clinton thing exploded, DeLay said he thought that the president should resign, that anybody who does something like that is not fit to hold public office. Well, he also says in the book that up until the time when he found Jesus, shortly after he had been elected to office in Washington, he had had any number of extramarital affairs. But he didn't resign then,
mm-hmm.
when he was doing that sort of thing. So he's holding the president up to a standard that he himself ignored for most of his adult life. Now, that's the kind of blindness I mean. Another example would be, he says in the book that he, as one of the authors of the contract with America,
mm-hmm.
made these various promises that if the Republicans took charge of Congress, of the House, they would do these following things.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, they did them, and he's very faithful to them, and you should trust him because he does this sort of thing. But then later on in the book, he says, well, he didn't vote for the limit on how many terms you could serve in Congress. When that was one of the things they promised to do when in the contract with America, but actually, he says, all they really promised to do was to introduce legislation to do this. They didn't promise to pass legislation to do this. And so he felt free in conscience to vote against a term limit for representatives.
That's a pretty good rationalization right there.
Well, yeah, I mean, but it's a very sneaky one.
Yeah.
My point is, he didn't realize it was sneaky. He didn't realize that in saying that, or in condemning Clinton over Lewinsky after he's talked about all the other things he's done, that he was revealing that he didn't have one and one added up together in his own mind. Oh, another example would be that he says in the end of the book that he doesn't judge any man prematurely, that he's very fair to everyone, but all through the previous chapters he's saying that he instinctively hates anyone who's a liberal, but before he even gets to know them, just knowing that they're a liberal makes them hate him. So it reminds me of my finding that high RWAs will say that they hate sin, but they love the sinner. That's one of the little sayings they've got in a box in their head.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then if you ask them that on a survey, is that how they feel? And then on the next page, you ask for their opinions about homosexuals. They will give you plenty of evidence that they hate the sinner. That it isn't that they hate sin but love the sinner. They hate both.
Mm-hmm.
And so they end up agreeing with statements like the AIDS disease that's killing homosexuals now is just what they deserve.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all this blindness. Now, your question was originally about closet gays.
Well, okay, but now hang on. You segued into the double highs.
Yeah.
And actually, let's pursue that for a minute. Because as you're talking, I was thinking, okay, we've established that 20-25%. Let's take the high end of it. 25% of the population are authoritarian followers. Now, what part of that would be double highs?
Oh, double highs are very rare. People who score highly on both the measures of authoritarianism are quite rare. About 8% of a sample would ordinarily do that. So you see, you're not even talking about 1 out of 10, maybe 1 out of 12 people. But double highs, even though they are very small a number, can be very influential because these are the people whom the religious right flocks to.
Mm-hmm.
And elects to office and supports wildly and fervently all the while they're in office. So they are very dangerous. There's this wonderful experiment we did with the global change game,
right,
in which we had university students sort of run the world. And one time we did it, the whole world was populated with ordinary authoritarian followers. And their world, the world they ended up creating, went into the toilet because they made so many disastrous decisions and so forth. But there wasn't any warfare. They sort of operate on a "you leave us alone, we'll leave you alone" thing, and everybody just sat in his own little continent and screwed things into the ground. The next night we ran the experiment with, again, the room was all full of people who scored high on the RWA scale, but out of 57 people, 7 of them were also double highs. They'd also scored high on the authoritarian leader thing.
Mm-hmm.
And 6 out of the 7 of them became world leaders. There were only 7 world leaders, and 6 of them were the double highs. So they just jumped into this role one way, by hook or by crook.
Mm-hmm.
And they just...
Even in one case where the fellow sort of had an insurrection and took over running the power behind the scenes, and I think the other case talked about was one actually had a revolution.
Well, you're very well read. I must say, you know my book very well. There were, out of the 7 guys who, out of the people who jumped up to become the leaders,
mm-hmm.
One of them was not the official leader. He didn't make himself the leader when they were asked, "Who wants to be leader of your group?" But he then went and became the assistant to the leader and ended up making all the decisions. That reminds me, I think, a bit about Washington nowadays, the White House.
Mm-hmm.
So he became the de facto leader, and everybody else from the other areas learn it. This is the guy you talk to if you want to get something done. The official leader is not in control of this. And then there was another double high who was representing another region of the country, and he wasn't the leader. He was back home working, but he led a revolution at home, so that when the leader came back at one point with a proposed deal to sell this, that, the next thing, all of the followers were now lined up behind this double high among the followers, and he took over and said, from now on, you have to bring all your decisions to us, and we have to ratify them. And everybody followed him, so he became the at-home leader.
So by hook or by crook,
6 out of the 7 of them became leaders, yeah.
And, okay, and then I interrupted you, I'm sorry. So what was the result of that run?
Oh, when that happened, there was intense bargaining among the leaders, because everybody was trying to get something from somebody else. And nobody on either night had any concern about the planet as a whole, compared to an earlier experiment in which we had the world filled with low RWAs, and they did a very good job taking care of the planet and the future and so forth. On this particular night with the double highs, the world went to hell in a different handbasket, but it still went to hell primarily because of warfare. One of the leaders started buying nuclear weapons, and then he declared war on India, which had no weapons at all to fight back with in this simulation. And so India surrendered immediately, and then this guy started threatening Africa, and various countries ran to North America and said, protect us. And the North American leader said, well, if you pay me enough, I'll protect you. And so the world was heading for a nuclear showdown when the simulation ended, as it was scheduled to end at a certain time. But lots and lots of over a billion people died in that run, because the elites were not looking after the world, and poverty just broke out like crazy in the third world and so on. It was a bad world. You wouldn't want to live in it.
And you think if the simulation had run for another 5 minutes, they would have had a massive nuclear war, and then pretty much the whole planet would have been vaporized.
Yes, that happened in an earlier run of the experiment when we had high RWAs in the room, and they were all running the world, and one of the countries, one of the regions declared nuclear war on the other, and they blew up the whole world. And so then they were given another chance to start over again and try and build a better world, and it still, with all these high RWAs around, it still went all to hell in a handbasket.
Well, and people might think, reading about this, well, okay, it's a bunch of college students, or in some cases, I guess, high school students. But anyhow, it's not the real world, and yet, if people in Washington in political office are disproportionately these double highs, there is probably some kind of corresponding risk to the things that they want to do in their priorities. I mean, look at the planet today. We have problems of global warming, running out of energy, a whole lot of different things that that our political class seems psychologically ill-equipped to deal with, or even to want to deal with.
First, yeah, you're right. Simulations of the world's future using university students are not the same thing as what really happens in the real world. Secondly, what happens in the simulation still looks awfully familiar,
yeah,
to what's happening in the world, and that's your point. And yeah, we've got a whole nest of double highs in power in lots of places, not as many as we used to have, hopefully a lot fewer in 2 years' time. But if you look at the decisions that have been made about, for example, global warming, then you see the disaster that can loom for us down the road when these people are making the decisions they do about the extraction industry, about profits, about making non-sustainable economic decisions that have short-run payoffs. All of those sort of things showed up in the global change game when high RWAs were running the world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I never really answered your question about the closet gays.
Okay, yeah, let's go back to that.
And I said I don't know the answer, so we're going back to nothing. suppose you did an experiment, and this is an experiment that I've done before, and you went into a classroom where you had given out a questionnaire a month earlier, and you said, here are the results of the questionnaire. One of the things I measured was your sense of self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
And here are your scores on the self-esteem scale. And you handed out papers to people, which supposedly gave them their personal score on self-esteem. But you didn't really give them their scores. Instead, you randomly gave half the class really, really high self-esteem scores. And then you gave the other half of the class really low self-esteem scores. And then you said, these scores actually are very important because a lot of research shows that people with high self-esteem on this scale do very well in life later on, and people who have very low scores do very poorly. And I was going to bring some of those studies along with me today, but I forgot. So if you just tell me, write your name on a piece of paper that I'm going to pass around, and tell me whether you want to see this evidence that your self-esteem score is important and valid, then I'll bring a copy for you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so you can then, if you have cleverly, sort of secretly coded who's a high RWA and who's a low RWA,
mm-hmm.
you can see the extent to which people are willing to entertain good and bad news about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The high RWAs, when they thought they had done really well on a self-esteem scale, they wanted to see the evidence. When they thought they had done poorly on the scale, they did not want to see the evidence that it was valid.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you might think everybody would be like that. Who wants bad news? Well, the people who will deal with bad news are the low RWAs. Whether they got good news or bad news about themselves, most of them wanted to see the evidence. So they face up to things that bother them about themselves. High RWAs don't. They're very defensive. They run away from themselves, and they've usually got all kinds of religious tricks up their sleeves that enable them to feel guilt-free after they've done something really awful. And so when it comes to dealing with closet highs, I think that's probably going to turn out to be part of the process. They're very good at denial. They're very defensive. Hmm. They run away from themselves, and they're very good at rationalization. They're very good at blaming other people for things they do, and they're very good at getting rid of any guilt they have for doing things that are wrong. So on some level, not a deep down level, because we know deep down inside authoritarian followers are not what they pretend to be on the surface very often. But on some more superficial level, on a public level certainly, and probably on an interpersonal level among their friends and so on, a gay high RWA can be very condemning of gays and not think it has anything to do with them, not think it has anything to do with hypocrisy and so on, because they really aren't gay.
I guess what I was getting at, though, is not the fact that there are the individuals like that, but that as a group, that there's a bizarre, psychologically unhealthy group dynamic going on in the Congress among all these members of the Republican leadership who are closeted gays.
Well, you mean that this is sort of like get thee behind me, Satan, that if they condemn homosexuality enough, nobody will suspect they're gays?
I don't know, maybe that too, but just the fact that they all know who each other are and they're working together, and the whole process that you describe, and that I think it goes beyond what you're describing also, denial and so forth gets transferred into all kinds of bizarre group priorities. I don't know. I mean, it just seems to me an odd situation.
Give me an example of the bizarre group priority. Like making gay rights a major issue in your reelection campaign?
Well, that would be one, but I would be thinking more in terms of their interactions with the military bureaucracy. In terms of trying to shape the military establishment the way that they want, including the personnel system.
Which is, I mean, I don't know, what do they want? What have you heard?
Well, it's a combination of things. One thing is it's an enormous money machine. I guess there's some dispute over who coined the phrase, but it's either the CIA or the Pentagon, the self-licking ice cream cone. You know, it's the largest money machine in politics. You actually talk at some length about Stanley Milgram. And I think that it's important to understand what Milgram did, because presumably, even though nobody would be allowed to repeat those experiments today because they're so shocking, no pun intended.
Yeah.
Presumably, people would react pretty much the same way today, and that's,
I think so. Yeah.
That's the scary part of your findings about the authoritarians, is that it's there are these groups of authoritarians, but then there's the whole milieu where people who are not necessarily of that personality type get drawn into things that otherwise they would say are totally objectionable.
Yes, it's a very good point to close on, because as I try to make it in the book, not only does it matter who we are, what kind of personalities we have and so on, but the situations we're in turn out to have enormous power over us. And if people don't know, Stanley Milgram at Yale in the early 1960s did some experiments in which he got people to deliver supposedly very painful, lethal electric shocks to innocent victims rather than defy the experimenter who was ordering them to give these shocks.
Even when the victims were saying, "Stop the experiment,"
screaming and hollering. Yeah. To be set free, even after the victim had supposedly passed out and was either unconscious and about to be killed or already dead, they kept going. And it wasn't just that two or three people did this, but most people did this in those experiments, in the basic experiment.
And not just the students, but then replicated later in a facility that had no evident connection to Yale and so forth. So it's consistent across samples.
And actually, Milgram himself didn't do any experiments on students. He was using people he recruited from the public.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, the real crunch here is two conditions that aren't well known of Milgram's experiment. He ran lots of different studies that are called the team teaching conditions. And in one of the conditions, there's one real subject who is sitting in front of the electric shock generator, and he's sandwiched between two Confederates who are also supposed to be teachers. And together they're deciding whether to administer shocks to this poor devil in the next room. Mm-hmm. And at one point, one of the Confederate teachers quits. He says, "I'm not going to do this anymore." And then a few shocks later, the other Confederate teacher says, "I'm not going to do this anymore." So there's just the real subject left, and the experimenter puts pressure on this one real subject to keep on delivering the shocks. Well, in that situation, almost everybody quits. Now, in another condition of the team teaching operation, the real teacher is there with another guy, just one Confederate, mm-hmm. and this other Confederate just blissfully goes along administering the shocks. The team, the real subject's job isn't to administer the shocks. He's like Eichmann loading trains. His job is just to pronounce sentence on the poor devil in the next room, whether he made a mistake and deserves to get shocked.
Mm-hmm.
But given that job of being part of this execution apparatus while not pulling any triggers himself, almost everybody just went along with it all the way to the end. So when you put those two conditions together, it's really pretty clear that how those people acted depended upon what the others around them did, what their peer group did.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good example of a very powerful thing that social psychology has discovered, and that is that the situation can very often run rampant over who we are as individuals. It wouldn't have mattered whether you were a high RWA or a low RWA in that experiment. Almost everybody did what the stooges around them did. So, and you see this, of course, in other things, and I cite the example of this execution unit in Poland that mm-hmm. the Nazis mm-hmm. ran during the Second World War, which was made up not of Nazi fanatics, but of ordinary men, and they became very skilled at killing Jews face to face because that was their job, even though they probably would not have been wildly authoritarian on any test anybody could have given them at the time. So we do have to realize that the situations can make almost everybody do hideous things. And the conclusion I draw from that is not only to know yourself, and because I'm sure I would have gone along with Milgram's experiment if he had asked me to serve in it at the time. I don't think I would now, but I would have then. So maybe knowing yourself helps. But also the real conclusion is you've got to be careful who becomes an authority, because malevolent authority can easily arrange situations that will make most people do hideous things.
It is a fairly dire warning. If you had to say on a scale of 1 to 10, how much trouble are we in politically because of the tendency towards authoritarianism these days, where would you rate it?
Today?
Mm-hmm.
7.5.
Okay.
Year ago, 9.
Okay. Well, that's encouraging.
Oh, yeah. I think we've got a chance. I say in the book that... because the book talks a lot about George Bush and his policies and his supporters and how they keep on believing things that have been disproved over and over again and so on, there's a real danger in writing a book that you hope will have some lasting value and just talking about the current situation. But maybe if anybody reads this book in 20 or 30 years, they'll realize how close we came to losing it all here in this country. And I hope we don't lose it all. I think we're moving in the right direction now. People have got to get involved and get active and become just as active as the other people on the other sides who are going to show up on Election Day and vote and get organized and save the American democracy, because it's very clear the authoritarians in power and the authoritarians who so zealously support them have no interest at all in democratic government.
And as you say, Bob, they will take a loss here and there, but they're going to regroup and they're going to come back. And it's,
We saw that when Clinton defeated the first George Bush after the Reagan years and so forth. The authoritarians didn't disappear. They reorganized, they got reinvigorated, and they came storming back, and they're not going to disappear. One of the great things we've got going for us, however, of course, is that they have so much trouble holding on to their own young people. They do, Christian fundamentalists in my studies do a very poor job retaining their youth. And so they've got an uphill battle to stay vigorous, but they clearly are vigorous right now and have the potential to be vigorous for a long time.
Well, certainly a lot to think about there. Again, the book... the link to the book is a free download, will be on the site, and I really hope that all of you listeners do download it and read it. It's funny, it's very well written, and there's a tremendous amount of insight in it. And for all you people who like methodology, it's not difficult, but there is a good amount of discussion of methodology, and there's a lot of footnotes. So please do take a look at it and read it. Bob, thank you very, very much for talking with me. I really appreciate it, and I've learned a lot.
You've been listening to an interview with Dr. Robert Altemeyer, a psychologist from the University of Manitoba who specializes in the study of the authoritarian personality and its impact on society. The interviewer was George Kenney, host of a wonderful blog and podcast that can be found at electricpolitics.com. On that site, look for the October 5th, 2007 podcast, where you will also find a link to Dr. Altemeyer's free ebook, The Authoritarians. As Altemeyer's research has shown, authoritarian personalities can be mitigated by a broadened social and intellectual horizon, and the number of those personalities fluctuates in society. Therefore, they are not some innate and immutable fact of human personality. For the feminist philosopher Genevieve Vaughn, the authoritarian behaviors of individuals are a subset of a larger system, patriarchy, which is authoritarian at its root. It is based on hierarchies of dominance and uses violence and coercion to create and maintain society. Our economics, the way we obtain the necessities of life, spring from this same mold. The system of patriarchy and its economic expression, the market, are overlaid on an older way of meeting human needs, which she calls the gift economy. This was once the economic system universally used by humans before patriarchy, and it is woman-centered, based on the paradigm of the mother who meets the needs of the child without payment or calculating an exchange. Vestiges of this economy still survive, though they are discounted and thus rendered invisible by patriarchy. In our reading last time, Vaughn analyzed capitalism as a system that relies on coerced giving from individuals, nations, and nature. Profit, she explained, can be seen as the gift given to the capitalist by the worker and those who support the worker in excess of the, quote, fair value of that worker's effort. We'll conclude the program with the next installment from Forgiving by Genevieve Vaughn, beginning Chapter 5, The Concept of Man. Vaughn writes, like language, the capacity to form concepts can be allocated to the biological hardware or to socialization. Much investigation is taking place of both possibilities. Some say our ability to recognize similar things must be a genetic endowment. Others believe that we form concepts by a process of comparison and generalization. For some, this process uses a prototype, possibly the image of the first thing of a kind a child has seen, or something of a kind present in her immediate environment. Through repeated comparisons, some common qualities are abstracted. An experiment which was conducted by Soviet psychologist Lev Vygotsky in the 1920s originated the prototype theory, and Vygotsky is identified with that current of psychology. Vygotsky described a number of stages of concept development, leading up to a final one-many stage, where the prototype or sample object acquired a stable one-many relation with a number of objects which were compared to it, excluding objects which were different. The many objects also acquired a common relation to each other by being compared to the sample and found similar to it in the same ways. This generalized the sample, and the common quality of the similar objects was a reflection of that generality. The sample had a name, and the objects that had the common quality also had that name. The description usually given of Vygotsky's experiment was provided by E. Hanfman and J. Kasanen in their book Conceptual Thinking and Schizophrenia. Quote, the material used in the concept formation tests consists of 22 wooden blocks varying in color, shape, height, and size. There are 5 different colors, 6 different shapes, 2 heights, the tall blocks and the flat blocks, and 2 sizes of the horizontal surface, large and small. On the underside of each figure, which is not seen by the subject, is written one of the 4 nonsense words, lag, bic, mer, sev. Regardless of color or shape, lag is written on all tall, large items, bic on all flat, large figures, mer on all tall, small ones, and sev on the flat, small ones. At the beginning of the experiment, all blocks, well mixed as to color, size, and shape, are scattered on a table in front of the subject. The examiner turns up one of the blocks, the sample, and shows and reads its name to the subject and asks him to pick out the blocks which he thinks might belong to the same kind. after the subject has done so, the examiner turns up one of the wrongly selected blocks, quote-unquote, and shows that this block is a block of a different kind and encourages the subject to continue trying. After each new attempt, another of the wrongly placed blocks is turned up. As the number of turned blocks increases, the subject by degrees obtains a basis for discovering to which characteristic of the blocks the nonsense words refer. As soon as he makes this discovery, the words come to stand for definite kinds of objects. For example, lag for large tall blocks, bic for large flat ones. And new concepts for which the language provides no names are thus built up. The subject is then able to complete the task of separating the four kinds of blocks indicated by the nonsense words. Thus, the use of concepts has a definite functional value for the performance required by the test. Whether the subject actually uses conceptual thinking in trying to solve the problem can be inferred from the nature of the groups he builds and from his procedure in building them. Nearly every step in his reasoning is reflected in his manipulation of the blocks. The first attack on the problem, the handling of the sample, the response to correction, the finding of the solution, all these stages of the experiment provide data that can serve as indicators of the subject's level of thinking, close quote. The one-many concept structure itself is important in cognitive psychology. While Vygotsky's experimental demonstration of possibilities of different, wrong kinds of uses of the sample lets us see what is not being done in one-many conceptual reasoning. Two of the possibilities of, quote, wrong reasoning show this clearly. The family name complex, in which the sample is held firm, and the qualities by which other objects are found similar to it vary, and the chain complex, in which the one-many character is lost because an object is found similar to the sample by one characteristic and next is found similar to the second object by a different characteristic, and so on. The, quote, wrong strategies show the importance of keeping the sample firm and trying to develop generality by repeatedly comparing objects to it with regard to the same similarities. At the end of the experiment, the sample itself is no longer necessary because a type of thing has been recognized as having one of the names that were given to the different kinds of things in the experiment. I thought about this for a long time, and it occurred to me that the word actually takes the place of the sample and takes over its generality. This gave me a second characterization of words, which I could add to that of words as communicative need-satisfying gifts. In fact, it was fitting that a word gift could take the place of the sample, which could not always be given as such, and which could probably usually not remain stable for very long except as an image. The word, on the other hand, with its infinite repeatability, has the character of being the same thing, even when every instance of its actuality is a different event from every other instance. By taking over the one-many function of the sample, the word helps the organization of the concept, so that the concept's members were considered similar to each other because of their common relation to their name, as well as because of their common relation to the sample. Once the relation of things to each other as similar, according to the same qualities, is established, the sample is no longer necessary, and the word can bring them to mind as a kind by itself. The reason for this is that, in the one-many relation, a polarity is established whereby the one is maintained as a point of reference, and the many are compared to it one by one. The word, taking the place of the one, maintains the polarity, bringing forward the relation of the many to each other as well as to itself. The sample or prototype must be kept firm with its qualities. If not, a consistent kind of category cannot be constructed, and our thoughts may wander from one association to the next. However, anything of a kind may be chosen as the one which will be held firm as the sample, and once the category has been constructed, the sample can be demoted from its one-many position and become again just a member of that kind. I make a point of saying this because I think the one or sample position has been misunderstood as constituting part of the gender definition, and therefore overemphasized, invested with special privilege, and projected into the structures of the society as self-similar patterns at many levels. The father and his family, the king and his subjects, the general and his army, the CEO and his business, etc., embody the one-to-many polar relationship established in concept development. The relation between money and products is also an embodiment of the concept, and we can use this polarized relation among objects to elucidate the one-many relation among persons. Even the relation between a person and her/his property can be seen as one-many relation deriving from the gender-invested concept structure, though perhaps it is more like the family name complex. And I'm reading from Forgiving by Genevieve Vaughn. The Privileged One. Privileging the sample position is particularly dangerous because the polarity and the concepts formed with its help are themselves originally innocent, useful ways of organizing our thoughts and perceptions. It is a very intimate and basic level of thinking that becomes invested with the pernicious privileging of the one position. Because it is so basic, this investment is hard to investigate, and we project it outside ourselves so that we can deal with it. Since we never think of tracing the origin of our strange one-many behavior back to concept development, we continue to act out the process at many different levels of society, creating structures which then interact with each other, compete, support each other, arrange themselves in one-many hierarchies. Again, together, these structures form the self-propagating social systems, which we call patriarchies. At the root of these systems lies, once again, the question of the male gender identity and masculation. Males have been taken as the samples for the category human. Boys' categorical gender difference from their nurturing mothers has made males seem to have to be samples in the one position if they were to be included in humanity at all. Women have nurtured them in this, giving way, not appearing as the ones to whom the many would be compared to find their human identity. Therefore, women have appeared to be lacking, deficient in the supposed human characteristics which men have. Abstract thinking, aggressiveness, individualism, leadership, independence, qualities having to do with competitively achieving the one position, appear to be, quote, human, and women seem to be inferior humans because that was not their focus. In fact, the women continued practicing the gift paradigm whenever that was not made impossible by scarcity, war, and individual violence of various kinds. The concept human was interrogated for centuries for its meaning. While philosophers considered women as inferior humans, not appropriate samples for that concept. Meanwhile, the gift paradigm, which the women were practicing, was and continues to be the source of meaning, community, and even of life itself. What we have considered to be the defining characteristics of the male gender are actually characteristics of the one position patched together with the patterns of taking the place of deriving from the role of the word in the definition and naming. They are taken up by boys in order to carry out the self-fulfilling prophecy of their gender concept as different from their mothers. The one position held by the father towards the family as many appears to be what the boy must achieve if he is to be called a man. The Oedipal injunction is thus not so much to kill the father as to overtake his position as the one. The simple logical consideration is that not everyone can be the one in a polar way, and that this is relational not to a permanent characteristic, may not be clear to children at an early age. The mandates of the male gender appear to say, be different from women, and grow to be equal or larger than the father, so as to be able to overtake his position and deserve the name man. The boy appears to be related to the nurturing sample himself before he can understand the implications of his gender name. Then the word boy takes the boy out of the category of the mother. Thus, the father's role of overtaking and dominance may seem to come from the word's ability to take the boy away from his identity with the mother. The ability to put things into categories appears to be a capacity of the father and an aspect of the role of the one. The father is the standard, like money, and this standard has the capacity to speak, and because he takes the place of the mother sample, to be the word which categorizes and divides. Every judgment resonates with a power he or his gender name seems to have had to divide male from female. The relation of a boy to his father becomes one of inferiority, of many to one, of property to owner, of things to a word or sample, a sample which is not gift-giving. Masculation is a kind of original dehumanization because the father model is objectified like a non-human thing. Then women are defined as not even that, while the relation among male concept members is overvalued. The Bible story of Joseph and his brothers deals with a situation in which the many brothers vie with each other for the one position to be inherited from the patriarch. Joseph's dreams about the many sheaves of corn and the sun, moon, and stars bowing down to him express this relation symbolically. When a boy takes on the father as the sample for his own concept, he is part of the real or potential many with regard to the one. His gender identity may appear to be that of striving competitively with others of the same gender for the one position. His father may be doing this himself in his work life. Taking the place of may also seem to be a mandate of his gender role, as males take the place of females, and the male sample and word takes the place of the female sample and its gift-giving way. Thus, what little boys perceive as their gender role at an early age is the incarnation of the sample position itself and a partial incarnation of the word. Being equal to or like the sample and taking the place of others become important in the male identity, while other orientation and gift-giving remain principles of the female identity. Making the male the sample for the concept of human cancels the perceived importance of gift-giving. Females and other males nevertheless continue to give to the males whose identities are constructed in this way, overprivileging them and especially rewarding those who do not achieve the one position. Thus, gift-giving supports this identity construction, even while it is being canceled by it and judged by it as inferior, even less than human, instinctive behavior. Gift-giving permeates human activities and is still the way we transmit goods and messages, communicate, and form our community. We have altered and distorted it, however, using it for the ones against the many. We are taught from our earliest days to misrecognize the gift-giving way and to give it other names: activity, housework, leisure, surplus value, profit. As we begin to recognize the dynamics of the two paradigms, we can give the appropriate value and the appropriate names to gift-giving. And I've been reading from For Giving by Genevieve Vaughn, originally published in 1997. You can download a copy of this book online at gift-economy.com. And you can download this and all previous episodes of this program at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
Like an unwelcome.